see it.
Hello and welcome to In Which. My name is Eli Carlson, and today I'm joined with...
Joined by...
Not going to let it slide this time, huh?
No. Jake Haddad. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning back into us, because you have to tune the internet to get the right signal, as we all know.
So I've been informed, yeah. I had an untuned internet earlier today, and it...
Broke your computer, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
See, just, it's all about the tuning. Wouldn't have this problem if we lived in the world of Star Trek.
That's true. You know, it's funny you bring that up. I was just thinking about Star Trek today, and I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that it's our topic of conversation today.
It is.
So...
Yeah, so did you... Here, let's first start on which Star Trek did you watch?
Next Generation.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Star Trek that I grew up with. Captain Picard will be my captain for forever. And, you know, and those were the storylines that I grew up, my dad watching, and thus sucking me into watching. so that was the, yeah, that's the one that's the closest and nearest to my heart. What about you? Which one have you... What would you say? I mean, I assume you've watched most of them. I know that you're much more of a Star Trek person than I am.
I am. I very much enjoy most of the offerings of Star Trek. Quick caveat for anyone who is curious, and this should come as a surprise to absolutely no one. I hate, with deep and abiding, burning hatred, the works of J.J. Abrams in the Star Wars oeuvre.
Yes. Yeah.
So those don't count. None of it. I despise every... And that includes Michael Chambon. And basically a lot of the new stuff. And I don't mean all the new stuff, because I will say... you were talking about Star Trek being sort of my jam. I've enjoyed Strange New Worlds.
So that's the one that I'm the least familiar with. I'm vaguely familiar with Picard and Discovery.
Just trash. Trashity McTrash trash.
Also, I just want to correct you before somebody else does. You said J.J. Abrams' Star Wars, which I know you also are not a fan of, but you
might. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Star Trek. Well, I could just... I think we could just put a basic...
J.J. Abrams. Just
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Just in general, if Abrams has his name attached to it. With the exception of Fringe, weirdly, I don't know if he just was really hands off on that, was busy on other projects.
Probably.
But
wasn't that about the same time as his Lost?
Maybe it was. Yeah, he maybe just produced it. Anyway, J.J. Abrams, you can suck all of the lollipops.
Yes, all of the lollipops. Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And like I said, I'm much less of a Trekkie. I have some basic knowledge of the original series. Again, Next Generation was the one that I was the most familiar with and grew up with. But the especially the newer stuff, I mean, apart from, I did watch at least the first one or two of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movies, and I will admit that the vast majority of the reason that I watched those was because I love Simon Pegg. As an actor.
Oh, yeah, not as a writer. Not as a writer.
No, not necessarily. Unless he's working with Edgar Wright, but
yeah, I think the opposite of J.J. Abrams is Edgar Wright.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, certainly. But yeah. I will say, so the we can start with sort of why J.J. Abrams is bad at Star Trek, and I'll try to contain myself to just Star Trek.
yeah, I mean, we can't get into everything all at once.
No, we'd be here all night. So one of the,
well, let's start with what good Star Trek is.
Okay.
And then,
sure.
And then we can move into, cause obviously you have criticisms and things of Discovery and, Picard.
Yeah,
so let's start with what it was that you, that drew you specifically, cause I'm going to let you kind of take the rein on that a little bit, but so far as what drew you to the original, Star Trek and what drew you to, I assume, the Next Generation, a lot of that earlier stuff.
Yeah.
And then we can kind of launch into from there, why the new stuff is bad.
So it's not just, I do want to say before we get going, it's not the new stuff isn't bad. It is just not good. But going back to why that is one of the reasons it is the older stuff drew me in was the imagination of it. When I was a kid, that was, you know, for a young boy in the 80s and 90s, that was what was on television. You could see the original series as a rerun, and I watched quite a few of those, and they were exciting, and you know, I didn't get everything that was happening.
Sure, it's hard to tell,
but
on those black and white TVs.
Right, but well, I mean, I wish I had a TV. My gosh. No, we just listened to it on the radio and acted it out for one another. No, really, what was fascinating about the original series to me was the world and, you know, going different places, seeing a ship flying through space. I saw Star Trek far before I ever saw Star Wars.
Sure.
So what I loved about it was the exploration and the sense of a better humanity, a better world in
sure.
general. And I thought the storylines back then, and I still think to a degree, they're quite compelling. I did not realize at the time that Star Trek, certainly the original series and Next Generation, and I would actually include Deep Space Nine in this as well, to some extent Voyager.
Sure.
That they were little mini they're vignettes about morality, about philosophy. What happens when
right.
X?
Right.
You know, what is a situation? A situation that is, what does it mean to dehumanize someone? Well, they don't go out of their way to sort of kick you in the face with it, but, you know, A Measure of a Man, which is a TNG episode, a very famous TNG episode in which Data's humanity is questioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's not it sets up the conflict between the scientist who is attempting to come in and wants to disassemble Data as if he's, you know, a ballpoint pen, and
right.
the humanity of Data, which is a fascinating study in and of itself, because of course Data isn't human.
Right.
And though,
so then what does it take to become human?
Well, or is it about becoming human? Because I think that's the beauty of, I don't want to get too far afield on this, but those were the questions. As I got older, I started to watch Star Trek, The Next Generation was on, and I started to pick up on those nuances.
Right.
I watched Deep Space Nine long after it came out, and Voyager quite a long time after they came. Well, I guess, yeah, early 2000s is when I watched them.
Sure.
And they were, to me, continuations. I know that there was a lot of, let's say, criticism about Deep Space Nine. In fact, it's interesting. It gets a lot of the criticism. So it gets similar criticism to much of the vitriol leveled at the newer Star Treks that are being produced. And I think it's the least convincing criticism, though I do understand it. Their criticism about Deep Space Nine was that it was a bit too rowdy. It was a bit too, you know, shoot 'em up, gritty, dark. You know, there was some pretty heavy pieces of morality being tossed around and explored. I never saw that, again, this is just me, I never saw those pieces of morality in DS9 as being incompatible with Star Trek. I really just saw it as a continuation. And of course, you have to remember that, like most science fiction, something we talked about a couple episodes ago, science fiction reflects in very strong ways the questions of the day.
Right.
And
well, that was what the original
series, good science fiction.
That was what the original series was very famous for. I mean, there's the first interracial kiss that was not aired in the UK and parts of the South. There was like, they had a bunch of things they were constantly questioning, pushing the things that were, because the thing, questions of the day were, you know, excuse me, were questions about race and equality and that kind of stuff. And, well, so there was
and citizenship and
right.
And what it meant to be, what if it was a question, it's kind of interesting because the question Roddenberry asked is, what if the world all realized we're in this together?
Right.
And created a, you know, went out into the stars and created this federation of planets, right? And this was before, you know, the much of the series was filmed. In fact, I think the entire series was filmed before the moon landing.
Isn't that true? Really? I guess I didn't really figure the timeline in my head that way, but that's interesting.
Fascinating, yeah. Really, to me, it certainly. You look at what they were talking about, and Apollo 11 hadn't even launched.
Wow. Huh.
So there's a lot of questions there. There's a lot of supposition about the future. You know, the 90s, there was this in Star Trek. In the 1990s, there was this eugenics war that happened. And
right.
But yeah, you get actually, it is quite... almost all of the series have had an interest in portraying humanity as moving towards something good or better, if you want to. I mean, and then there are questions about, is this the right direction? Is this good? And they can explore that within the framework of the show. What has, moving on to what is bad about Star Trek currently.
Right.
Or not necessarily currently, but the more recent, the restart.
Right.
Of Trek is that it attempts to be, it attempts the philosophy, it attempts to ask the grand questions, but it doesn't ask them. It just says, shut up, you're wrong, shut up, think the way that I want you to think.
Right.
And that's it. There's no presentation or nuance of all the many sides, because as we both know, there are many sides to most arguments. Not all, but most. And well, there isn't any nuance. There's very little nuance in the latter series. And I would start that with Enterprise, which has the worst theme song ever. It has words in it. There's words in the theme.
Yeah, I mean,
it's so bad. The show isn't terrible. It's passable. It's fine.
I was going to mention something really quickly here. You were talking about how it says, you know, no, shut up, accept my way of thinking or leave, right?
Yeah.
Granted, I've watched clips and pieces. I've never watched a full episode. I'm in the course of my research into the more modern Star Trek for the sake of this episode. I was able to find a variety of different things online. But one of them that stood out to me, and I thought it was a joke. I thought it was somebody that edited it together in this way to make it seem this way. But it's an episode with H. John Benjamin. Where he's a geneticist or something, and he crossbreeds the tribbles with human DNA or whatever. Anyways, and he, the captain, is just straight up telling him to shut up, and the conversation's over, and he's like being very polite and trying to get his point across and trying to ask questions and verify, and just keeps on getting shut down and shut down and shut down. And again, I thought this was a joke. I thought somebody had edited this together for the sake of just comedy. And then I realized this was an actual part of the episode. And that his death was treated as just kind of a jokey episode of like, well, he was just an idiot and that's why he died. And it's like, well,
yeah,
that's...
what Who wrote? There was. I saw that video a while ago when it came out as well. So I never. That was one of the episode. One of the. That was eight. I'm not remembering correctly. I think that was something called Lower Decks or something.
No, Lower Decks was a.
That's the animated one, isn't it? One, yeah. That's one I haven't watched. But this was a series. It was like a. It was a spur series. It wasn't. Well, around the same time as Discovery, and it had several different small episodes. I'm not entirely sure what the purpose of it was. Well, yes, who wrote? There was that video makes an interesting point because it calls back to the Next Generation episodes with Ensign Barkley, and I cannot remember the name of them. But they focus around a member of the Enterprise crew, Ensign Barkley, who is an engineer, I believe.
Yeah.
And he's not very sociable, and he spends a lot of time in the holodeck, very much disassociating from reality to make himself feel better in a world that he can control, where he is amazing, where he's the greatest.
Yeah.
And Picard's... Well, so basically, Riker and Geordi come to Picard and say, look, we want to get rid of this guy. He sucks. He's not adapting to the crew. He's just all of the reasons. They had good reasons. He's inefficient. He doesn't get along well. He doesn't do his work when we need him to. All of the things that would get you canned in any, even a utopian sort of military, exploratory venture. And Picard responds something to the effect of, no, I think you need to help him. You need to give him a chance. Find a way to connect with him. That is your job as his superior officers and as officers in Starfleet anyway. Well, and they do. They end up coming alongside him and getting to know him, and he turns out to be, he's odd and he's got some difficulty relating to people and does prefer fantasy to... the real world, as it were.
Right.
But they learn to like him, and he learns to be a bit more...
A functional member of the crew. Yeah,
a functional member of the crew. And interested in their lives at the same time. So...
Well, and this is something, though, that I've seen in a variety of different clips that people have pulled together. I would give the name of the YouTubers that I had found these clips from, but really there's no point because there's been so many that you can just go look for them yourself. But that have compiled these lists of episodes and clips, but of a variety of times where there'll be some character that is just being put down by the rest of the crew, rather than being taught along or working as a team or whatever. They're just told, no, get out of the way, you're doing that wrong. And it's like, well, but where's the rest of the teamwork and working? It's always something that was Gene Roddenberry actually wanted specifically for the first for the original series and things, was that there could be the crew could not be at odds with each other. They had to be on the same team, because they couldn't be infighting. It could be the crew of the Enterprise versus the aliens, or versus the threat, or versus the whatever, but it couldn't be infighting, because it just wouldn't work.
Right. What we call colloquially drama now.
Right. Which obviously was lessened a little bit in later series and later episodes and stuff, but for the most part that had been kept true for a lot of Star Trek, and I think that that's something that they kind of blatantly threw out the window. At least it seems. Again, it seems like they threw that out the window in the new series. And actually, there's a Vanity Fair article about where they were interviewing. I can't remember the directors or the writers' names of the Star Trek Discovery series.
Michael Chambon is one of them. I can't remember the other ones.
But they, Brian Fuller, Alex Kurtzman.
Kurtzman, that's who it is. Chambon might be the director.
Yeah. But Brian Kurtzman. Fuller and Alex Kurtzman were being interviewed, I believe, by Vanity Fair. And they were talking about how, like, they said two things. One, they said that they needed to appeal to the diehard Star Trek fan. They needed to the people that were this, the diehard Star Trek fans. They needed to appeal to them first and foremost. And then they went on to say that the diehard Star Trek fans, the true Star Trek fans, would watch anything that came out. So they didn't really need to, you know, they could go off script, so to speak. And then they went on at the very end to say that it didn't really matter about the old Star Trek fans. They were more interested in getting new Star Trek fans. And then when, what's his name? Jonathan Riker. Jonathan...
Franks.
Franks. Was asked, he said, how many of the fans that could approach you do so as a, you know, knowing you from the new series versus the old series? And he says, virtually none for the new series. That they approach him for. And I was like, interesting. So I actually went and looked this up. I don't know if you've done this or not, but I actually went up and looked on Rotten Tomatoes for Star Trek Discovery. Or STD, as it's known by the naming convention of Star Trek. Anyways.
I hope not. Sure.
But anyways, so for season one, they got an 83 critic score and a 49 audience score. Out of 374 critics and a 5,000 plus audience members, which not bad, you know. That's
sure.
That's all right. Season two got an 81 out of 209 critics, and a 36% out of 2,500 audience members. So that's they only got half the response from the audience members that year, which is strange.
Wait, you said 81.
81%.
Percent. Gotcha.
Sorry,
gotcha.
81% from a 209 critics.
Got it. So critics. Right, yeah. So okay. Continue, please.
So then in season three, you got 91%. So the percentage went up, which is great. Out of 35 critics.
What?
Yeah. So 209 critics for season two, 35 critics for season three, and they got a 91%. And the audience gave it a 40%, which is better than season two, but worse than season one, out of 1,000 audience members. For season four... it got an 88% fresh for season four, which is one of the lower ends. But that was out of 17 critics. And then it got a 21% out of the remaining 1,000 audience members that wrote in about it. So anyway. Yeah.
I think that speaks more to... that speaks more to the interest the studio had in gleaning... critics that were had favorable impressions of it.
Sure.
And you know, the terrible thing about that is, and I
just thought it was interesting simply because of two things. One, the audience score remained consistently abysmal, and the audience members that were responding continued to drop. And then second of all, that the critics, while remaining mostly positive, just kept on dropping a number to the point that season five, even though it hasn't come out yet, it has critics reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and there's 14 critics that have written about it. So like,
wait, Discovery is still going?
Yeah, this is its last season this year. So,
I must have missed that it was still going.
April 5th, I think, is the first episode that drops.
What? It's still going. I gotta be honest. I really thought that it had stopped, after the fourth season. I did not.
No, I'm looking at it right now. April 4th, The Red Directive drops on April 4th.
So I guess if you consider me, all right, I'm male. I'm about 40. I would be the target audience for this sort of thing. And I can't bother watching it. I watched the first season and I was so absolutely dismayed by what I saw. And this is not a Star Trek critique. This is a critique of writing in general. It falls into the same writing traps that so many projects in the last, let's say, 10 years
mm-hmm.
have tripped into, which is, its writing makes you wonder if they know what an adult does. Mm. How does a mature individual a flawed mature individual, but a mature individual, how do they deal with situations, especially considering the time period in which the episodes are set. I will also point out that there's Discovery and Strange New Worlds are both set back. So what they're essentially trying to do is rewrite the canon.
Right.
As opposed to, which is classic J.J. Abrams. Let's not build anything. Let's only tear stuff down.
Right.
And it doesn't work because you're trying to shoehorn in things that have been decided already. You go, well, we can do it. Yeah, you can.
Right.
You absolutely can do it, but should you? I mean, right. It's the same. It's a sort of philosophical question that would be asked in better series. It doesn't. You get Picard, which was. I don't really know how to talk about Picard. I think I would have to watch it again, but I won't because it's so bad. The first season in particular is phenomenally poorly written. Sort of to the point where I reduced my opinion of Sir Patrick Stewart.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's that bad. And everybody does projects for different reasons. I get that. But sure. this isn't just a project. This isn't just a movie that he's in. This isn't a cameo appearance or this is him attempting in some way to reshape a beloved character with the help of complete incompetence.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's stunningly bad. However, I think it's important, besides just going through and trashing the later Trek, that we talk about what was good about Star Trek and what perhaps is good. And I would like to move us toward perhaps asking, one of the classic debates is the best captain. So sure. I would like to have that conversation with you.
Absolutely. I will say just really quickly before we move on to that conversation that it seems to me, based off of everything that I've found online regarding Discovery and regarding the new stuff, because I didn't look for, like, pieces tearing it apart. I wasn't looking for puff pieces or pieces tearing it apart. I was just looking for any information that I could find on Star Trek. It all just seemed to be very negative, except for the one thing that seemed to be a consistent positive across the entire Star Trek Discovery series, anyways, was that the greatest creature actor of all time, the incomparable Doug Jones, has had steady work for 5 years. So, I mean, if there's any reason to applaud Star Trek Discovery, I think that would be it. But he deserves the work.
All right. I'll give him that one. I'll give him this.
Perfect.
Because he doesn't get anything for the first season. It was shit. I don't care how great a character, creature, actor you are. That's all well and good, but...
No, I'm just thankful that I think Doug Jones is criminally underappreciated by most people. So the fact that he's had steady work for 5 years, I'm very, very happy for him.
Good. All right. Well, shout out to Doug Jones and his work.
But yes, let's get into this discussion though of which is the better captain.
Well, I think there's arguments to be made. Let's I'm going to discount entirely Discovery's various captains. They are roundly terrible. Like TNG would have this thing about. Admirals being, I don't know why, but admirals were almost always evil.
Right, or controlled by space
slugs. Yeah, there was that episode. Yeah, there was, there's all these different, they're bad at their job, or they're incompetent, or they're, basically
willingly
war criminals.
Evil, yeah.
Yeah, they're active. It was so frustrating after, like, really? That you get a star on your shoulder, and suddenly you go you know, power mad? What kind of utopia is this?
Well, you know what they say, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
No, but you would, I mean, it's power, is power even a thing? You can have whatever you want in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Replicators, make it all.
Right.
You can make whatever you want. As long as you have power, you're good. Which apparently they do in abundance. So excluding Discovery, again, because it's a retcon, a bullshit retcon, I will include, I think we should include Strange New Worlds, because while it is a bit of a retcon, it I think it has some utility with Captain Pike, because he was a real character. They're just sort of, I see it more as expanding on his background. I don't know what's going to happen with it. It may turn out to be a shirtwaist factory fire. But I'll give it the benefit of the doubt until it completely and totally falls apart.
Can I ask you a question really quickly?
Sure.
Having not watched Strange New Worlds or any of the rest of that kind of stuff, is there an actual episode where there is a Klingon boy band?
I don't know.
Okay.
I have not seen that episode.
That is something that I found online, which again I thought was a parody thing, and I just was like, I don't know what this is, and I don't want to know what this is, and I want to believe that it's a Lonely Island style parody of Star Trek. And then I clicked away.
Let's take a brief pause and refresh ourselves a bit before we get into this heavy conversation about the best captain. And other lessons. I think we should talk about certainly some of the bigger points, which I suppose may come out when we talk about captains. But yeah, let's take a brief pause.
Great.
And
we'll be right back after these messages.
Mas cerveza, por favor.
With our patented formula, ancient Mesopotamia and ancient India.
I take a seat at Politico.
Let's see it.
Well, we're back, I suppose. So before the break, we had discovered, well, Eli discovered that there was an episode, season 2, episode 9 of Strange New Worlds, wherein a lot of singing happens. This I have not seen because I am not all the way through season 2, and I would bet, though I don't know, that it's some kind of external force forcing everybody to think that they're singing or to sing or something like that, a la once again with Feeling from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's idiotic.
Sure.
And it reduces, there's a seriousness in tone that you can't really, it's hard to regain that seriousness from a position like, oh, we're going to have everybody sing. And there's definitely a good reason for this. It's not just because we got bored and wanted to make a musical episode in the second season. Are you running out of ideas that quickly?
I mean, yeah. I think it works really well for less serious TV shows like Scrubs, where they did the My Musical in season 6.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah, that was great.
But
it's a comedy. It's meant to be silly.
Right. Well, and this is actually something... So this is something that is levied against the Orville, as long as we're talking about Star Trek.
Should definitely talk about the Orville, though.
Yeah, we should. I agree, but people have said that it shouldn't be even considered in the same ballpark as Star Trek because, whereas Star Trek is, you know, when they had the Borg threat, it was very serious the entire time and all the rest of these things.
Yeah,
and,
very much so.
When they did a similar type of thing in the Orville, it wasn't until like 30 minutes into the 2-episode special that the, you know, threat actually started looming. And I was like, well, yeah. But the Orville's a comedy series.
Right.
And so, like, the fact that they spent 30 minutes of 2 episodes, over 2 episodes, not taking it seriously and making jokes out of it kind of makes sense, don't you think? Like that seems like such a silly thing. Like, of course, and the whole fact of the matter is that Seth MacFarlane's, the whole reason the Orville exists, if nobody knows, is that Seth MacFarlane was trying to do a new Star Trek series, and he got greenlit, and then at the last minute they were like, nope, actually you can't have this.
Yeah, they pulled the rug out from him and gave it to, you know, Chabon, Kurtzman, and Abrams, all of whom should find a way to just take a cricket bat to their genitals.
Yeah,
I mean, I can help. I'm available.
I, you know what?
I'm available, sure, for this. I don't even need to be paid. I will pay them.
What an incredibly kind offer. I'm sure that they are going to be blowing up your phone any minute now for it to accept that offer. But
yeah,
but no, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Seth MacFarlane, well, okay, so I believe it was Kurtzman that straight up said that he's more of a Star Wars guy.
Well, he's not, though, because he's just, well, sure, not.
But he is, in the same way that J.J. Abrams is.
Right, right, right. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He saw a clip on... Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say...
It infuriates me.
I was just going to say that's what he considers himself, right? Is that he considers himself a Star Wars guy. And so he has this 5 to 10 year plan for Star Trek that is modeled after Star Wars in his mind somehow. I don't ask me how that actually is the case, but that's what he claims. As opposed to Seth MacFarlane, who is a Trekkie. Like he is a Trekkie. That is his bread and butter. He loves it. what's the other show that
Which other show?
I'm just completely blanking on it's a Star Wars show, except it's not.
It's a Star Wars show.
Rebel Moon. Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon.
Oh, that's not Star Wars. That is trash.
I know it's not, but it was meant to be. Zack Snyder wanted it to be, and then they were told, like, he was told, no, you can't run a Star Wars show, and so he made Rebel Moon.
Well, I mean, if Rebel Moon is any indication, he should not have been let anywhere near Star Wars.
Sure.
I mean, you can't break it anymore, I guess. Maybe you can. I don't know. That's a conversation for another episode.
Sure. But my point is like, it's just like, it's the same. That was done very badly. And this is just from somebody that is actually a Star Wars or a Star Trek fan. Sorry. Is actually a Star Trek fan that then wasn't ever able to have the opportunity to run it. As opposed to people that are Star Wars fans trying to run a Star Trek franchise. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. They're, like we said way earlier, Star Trek has always been about philosophy.
Right.
Now, and you can, it's got punching and seduction and...
Well, but yeah.
Picard fucks.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he does. There's an entire episode where Picard goes on vacation to, what's the vacation planet? It's what is it called?
Boob world.
I can't remember. It's a vacation world. It's like a luxury world, and he meets up with this woman. They have an adventure, and the whole impetus for writing that episode was Patrick Stewart saying, you know, I'd like to fight a little bit, maybe get laid in the show. You know, I think that'd be kind of fun for the captain. He's pretty staid and kind of, you know,
Earl
stoic
Grey,
and hot. Yeah, Earl him and his, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that I want it where he fucks and fucks shit up. How about that? And of course, he does. It's a wonderful episode.
Yeah, I mean, but there are those episodes, but there's also episodes where
Drumhead.
Is that what
the Drumhead is the name of an episode that is quite different to that, in which an admiral, another horrible admiral, shows up on the Enterprise and accuses all kinds. Basically, she's looking to root out a conspiracy theory she's looking to follow a conspiracy theory to root out some kind of fifth column. But she doesn't, because, of course, Picard is there to talk her down, to prove that she is not truly acting in the interests of the Federation.
Well,
instead chasing something, basically creating, you know, going on a witch hunt for imaginary witches.
Well, so this is, yeah, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Though. So the, like, there's another episode called Evolution in TNG, where there's a bunch of nanites that take over the, so sentient nanites that take over the Enterprise. And their solution to this problem, because they think that it's attacking them, but their solution to the problem is to try to do, because they understand that it is an intelligent entity, they try to develop a line of discourse with it and figure out what it is, what does it actually want, what is it doing, and they succeed. And the end of the episode is with them helping the nanites, you know, find a place to be and exist, and the right. nanites actually repair the ship and all the rest of this kind of stuff. And from what I understand, Discovery did a very similar episode in which an artificial intelligence took over the ship in some way, and their method of dealing with it was to kill it cruelly and slowly to get revenge on it. I think that what comes down to is that if your Star Trek series, if you can't take all the characters in your Star Trek series and stick them in a room together and do a bottle episode in which they are, there's nothing, it's them in the four walls, then and it be good, be genuinely good and interesting, then you don't have a good Star Trek show.
Yeah.
And I think that is the measuring stick that I would use for Star Trek in general. And because it's not about the adventures, really. The adventures are great. The adventures are fun. We love the adventures. We love the you know, big sets and the space battles and all the rest. That's fun. We love that. But the point of Star Trek is characters. And it's how the characters are reacting to those environments and reacting to those types of things. And if the impetus for your show is the questions and the characters and how they react, and who they are as people, as moral creatures, if that is the driving force behind your show, then you can put them in very interesting and explosive environments, but you can also put them in a room around a table together and have that also be very interesting. But if your entire thing is based off of just the action aspects of it, or just trying to
say snarky that, jibes and,
right.
and undercutting people's...
Well, and to not actually have a conversation about anything. Like, it seems to me that from all the clips and all the pieces that I've seen on it, is that it seems like the new Star Trek's main motivation is to say that this is what you should believe. We're not going to have a conversation about it. This is what you should believe. And if that is what you're doing in your show, then you've lost the point of Star Trek. Because even when Star Trek was a little pushy with what they thought was the right moral answer... they never outright said it was the right moral answer. In fact, there's the episode where Worf is the only person that has his blood will save some Romulan. And because the Romulans and the Klingons do not have a good history together, Worf refuses and he says, no, let him die. And despite even Picard trying to get him to do it, Worf flat out refuses. He says, I will do it if you order me to, but otherwise I refuse. And of course, there's the whole moral question about was that actually an okay thing to do, and you know, so on and so forth. Like all these other questions go around with it, but
yeah, but it's understandable. It's within the character to that makes sense that you would have those qualms.
Right.
Those are true to the culture, true to the character.
Right.
You know, who especially at that time.
Right.
In Worf's
but they weren't
career.
Saying that what Worf was doing was right. Or wrong, they were just simply saying this is what Worf is doing,
right?
And while there were certainly characters that were, and obviously Captain Picard himself was frustrated with the fact that Worf wouldn't, you know, choose kindness over violence and vengeance, he wasn't about to override his own morals. You know what I mean?
His own code, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that those, like, that makes it a much more interesting thing as opposed to simply, you know, firing somebody because they happen to not get along with you.
Yeah. Well, and this is the same, the impetus for writing those kinds of bad storylines, not the war storyline, but the you know, let's just kill it, or you know, deciding that this character is ultimately always right, always good, there isn't any background, or if there is a background to them, that is, if they're a little hard-edged, it's because they have a sad, something sad, something bad, something terrible, tragic happened in their background, and that's why they are the way they are, and it's okay that they're like this, and we're not going to try and change them, and we're not going to also, as writers, allow them to change.
Right.
One of the interesting things is the rewriting of Captain Kirk by Abrams and Co.
Mm-hmm.
And which is continuing, by the way, in
is it?
In, well, it's so Stranger Worlds is Captain Pike was the captain of the Enterprise before Captain Kirk.
Right, right, right.
And eventually in the first season, much of his dilemma is that he knows what he is going to become, which is a severely limited individual who is scarred and broken in a horrible accident, even that medical technology in that era cannot fix.
Yeah.
Somehow. But, you know, there isn't a... The rewriting of Kirk is that he's just... And this is where I was talking about earlier with the why I dislike J.J. Abrams' version and his movies. He made Kirk a one-dimensional rebel character, the rebel without a cause. Oh yeah, he just rebels. He's super smart, but he just can't be contained by the system, man.
Right.
He listens to cool music and drives cars off cliffs for fun. When in fact that's not Kirk.
Right.
The Kirk of the Alpha canon is someone who saw incredible amounts of death and pain at a very, very young age. So as his homeworld was devastated by a crop failure. So this is the 1960s this is written in. And so what you're looking at is somebody who read essentially The Population Bomb by Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who's saying that with the way, predicting. The Population Bomb predicted that with the way that we did agriculture, we would be unable to support Earth's growing population. We would all starve to death.
Mm.
This was going to happen. This was inexorably in our future. And then Norman Borlaug came around and proved the Ehrlichs very, very incorrect. But that was later on.
Sure.
And so the writers of Star Trek are looking at this and saying, what if that happened on somebody's planet? Well, when that happens is the planet begins to starve that Kirk is on, Kirk is raised on, and the governor kills a whole bunch of people he considers undesirables to stop them from, like, to relieve the pressure on the agricultural system. So we're just going to kill all the undesirable. I mean, think about that as a background.
Right.
For Captain Kirk, his, you know, one of his mentors, he does the right thing, and one of his mentors gets, he basically loses his career track, and eventually comes back to kind of try and kill Kirk. But you know that, so he's constantly having these horrible things happen to him. One of his best friend in an episode, I'm forgetting the name of the episode. But achieves his best friend from the academy, and afterward achieves Q-like status essentially, and he's forced to sort of kill him to stop him from transcending, and all of this builds into a person who has a particular set of ideas and codes and motivators that define his actions. He is not a one-dimensional character.
Right.
People who don't watch anything but TNG or certainly Discovery think of Kirk as only two things. Well, he's pretty dumb and he's a misogynist and he
right.
you know, he's kind of brutal. But he grows in this. One of the great examples of this is in the Star Trek movies, where his son is his only son, right? He barely reconnects with this young man, the son of him and Carol Marcus. And his son is killed by the Klingons. And there is a point, and I'm trying to remember which, it's four, where Kirk and Spock kind of go head to head on this and have a very mature conversation about what is happening and why this peace treaty and this peace with the Klingons is important, and not just important, but imperative. And more than that, even the right thing to do. But Kirk can't see past that because he's so deep in his own grief. And that's not, Spock doesn't belittle him.
Right.
He just states the point and understanding that this horrible tragedy has happened to Kirk and regarding his son. He is understanding of that as understanding as Spock can be.
Yeah.
All of that to say that this is a depth of character you just do not see.
No. Just before we move on very quickly, the episode you're talking about, his best friend was Gary Mitchell. The name of the episode was Where No Man Has Gone Before, if anyone's interested. But
thank you. Yes, Gary Mitchell.
I think that this aligns with what I was saying about, like, these, you can't have, if you have uninteresting single-dimensional characters, then you can't put them in a room and have them talk, because you will have a bunch of one-dimensional conversations, and those, like, nobody wants to watch that. Like, you can't have, you know, just Spock be purely logical with no other aspects of his personality, and Kirk be just a womanizing rebel, and that be the basis of his personality, and, you know, whatever. Like, you can't have these incredibly basic characters, because then when you do have a bottle episode, then nobody's going to watch. You know, and that was what they did very successfully in the past, is that they created these characters, and they created, you know, it's like for instance, having Worf in TNG not be willing to, you know, give up his blood to save Romulan, save somebody that he, you know, hates for good reason. Also, like, regardless of whether they actually took the opportunity to explore this, it does give the opportunity to explore Worf's growth throughout the rest of the series and be able to change that character. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, Jakar and Londo from Babylon 5.
Ah, yes.
You know, where they start off being horrific enemies, of constantly being at each other's throats, sometimes quite literally. And
sometimes they just watch each other almost die.
Yeah. I can just watch you die and I don't have to do anything.
We're in here. All right. Sorry. We're getting way off.
Sorry. But yes. Anyways, but that's what that reminds me of, though, is like that because they, by not writing them as, oh, they had this one time together and they understood each other and they understand the problems. It's like, no, they have this massive history and they have to have opportunity to be able to grow and change and develop the relationship that they end up having towards the end of the series, as opposed to just writing very basic characters. They're like, oh, I don't like you. Okay, well, then we should fight. Or, well, we should see why we don't like each other and get over it right away. It's like, no, that's not realistic.
Yeah, there's got to be deeper drivers of action, I think, is what we're kind of getting on.
Yeah,
getting,
I think,
to
so.
Anyway. I mean, and also there's deeper questions. I hope, we'll see, knock on some wood, that is something that happens in Strange New Worlds. I don't think it did. I don't know. You showed me that clip during the break and it was just so frustrating that I'm losing
hope as we speak.
I'm losing my religion on that one.
You know, I think that in all of this, you know, we talked about creating interesting characters, having the various members of the crew specifically being members that get along more or less together, are not having drama for drama's sake. And I think that obviously at the center of all of that is the captain of the ship, and they kind of set the mood, if you will, for the rest of the crew. So with that, let's kind of get into that part of our conversation there. Which of the captains do you think, I guess for the lack of to continue along the same vein that I was continuing down, which captain do you think provides the best mood?
Susan Ivanova.
Amen.
Oh, wait, sorry. Okay. I think you have, I think the ground rules have to be, you have to consider them in the entirety of Alpha canon.
Sure.
Which is why I can't pick Picard. Because he does a lot of great stuff in TNG, and he's phenomenal, and I am forever devoted to him if he had just fucking retired. But he came out of retirement and then helped a person murder somebody and then said, it's okay, she was mentally distraught. It's fine. It's fine that she murdered him. It's fine.
Wait.
Yeah. Have you watched Picard?
No, I didn't and I also didn't realize that Picard was considered Alpha canon.
Yes, so Picard is on the same timeline. There is no change to the timeline between TNG and Picard.
Oh. Right?
So there's a continuation there. It's not
Well, that's disappointing.
Yes, it's not, you know, Abrams, there's a name for it.
Kelvin universe.
The Kelvin universe. Yes, yeah, the Kelvin universe.
Or Kelvin timeline, sorry.
Yeah, universe timeline. It's just shit is what it is. But it's not that. And I actually, I have heard a couple of, I've read some criticism, when I say criticism, I mean like literary criticism of Discovery. And they're saying, well, what if early on, this is kind of like a different universe. This is a mirror. They've got a bunch of that shit.
Sure.
They're constantly jumping around the mirror universe. It's such a,
sure.
Somebody read Abrams.
Somebody read Doctor Strange once and was like, "This is great."
I don't even think they read Doctor Strange. I think they said to themselves, "What's a way that we can do whatever we want and have no consequences, and thereby make no points, but still have a lot of fun and spend money?" Which they did, a lot of money. Anyhow, I'm going to discount Discovery from this. Like I said before, I will keep Strange New Worlds. I actually think one of the best captains is Captain Janeway.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because it's a toss-up for me between Janeway and Kirk.
Yeah.
And what I like about both of them is that Janeway is... they both are flawed individuals who stick very solidly, very very... rigorously to their moral code.
Mm-hmm.
Janeway is inflexible in much of what she does. Yeah. Not everything. She, of course, she's presented as a human character, but she doesn't like to back down. She doesn't like to do things that aren't her way.
Right.
And she gets them in all kinds of problems with that. And sometimes her iron will gets them out. I always thought of her as very, I mean, I don't know if this is true, but she seems to me very modeled on kind of a Margaret Thatcher in the, you know, 24th and a half century. Bugs Bunny reference for all of you who have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm going to stick with Janeway. I don't particularly care for Voyager as a show.
Sure.
But it had an interesting premise, did you watch Voyager this?
I have not watched all of Voyager, no.
Okay. But you know, the beginning, they're chasing this, let's call them an outgroup, the Maquis, right? And they basically think that the Federation is dumb and they don't want to do what the Federation wants them to do. And even though they have philosophical differences, let's just say.
Uh-huh.
So they, you know, then they find themselves, you know, kicked over into the Delta Quadrant, and they have to come back. So they have to band together, and it's great. she does such a good job of holding that crew together. And you would understand why she would lean into that natural toughness and sort of hidebound reaction.
Yeah.
To situations. Kirk is again another flawed captain, but his thing is that he kind of plays fast and loose with the Starfleet rules, not his own rules, the Starfleet rules, but at the same time holds up their principles above everything else. Like, to him, those are the most important principles.
Yeah.
So I think he sets a good, he's an, from a writing perspective, his crew works very well with him, because you have different points of view that circle around him and interact with him and move through and, you know, push him out of the way sometimes. Nicely, I should say. Yeah. He's just not it. The reason I give it to Janeway is because I don't think Kirk is oftentimes a mouthpiece for the writers. Again, TOS particularly was a show about, you know, making philosophy accessible to the masses.
Yeah.
And whereas Voyager was complete. I think what Voyager lacked, and this is nothing against Janeway necessarily, but what Voyager lacked was differences of opinion that manifested in real ways. Oftentimes, like, I don't think we should do this. And then 5 minutes later, like, okay, Captain, let's do it. It's kind of a milquetoast crew, but I like Janeway. I think she's great.
Yeah, Now that I would have to discount Picard,
you can absolutely love on old Jean-Luc.
No, unless I can remove Picard the show from the Well, then in that case, I was actually vying between Kirk and Janeway as well.
No love for Sisko?
I'm not super familiar with Deep Space Nine, so the three captains that I would have to choose from.
Sisko's crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that's the interesting thing about Sisko, is that he is both this incredibly deeply intellectual, he's presented as this deeply intellectual man, but that dude does some wild stuff. He's kind of your halfway. He oscillates between Kirk and Picard, in fascinating ways. Also, he's in a very different situation, but I don't see him. He's obviously central to that show, but the reason I didn't pick Sisko is because I don't think he controls the mood nearly as much as any of the ship captains do.
I'm my Deep Space Nine knowledge is sorely lacking. I don't think I've.
It's good.
Is it? I'll have to go.
It is actually good. You got to get through. Once Sisko grows a beard, it's good.
Oh, okay.
He Rikers very well.
He Rikers very well. Yeah, I mean, I think you made a convincing argument for Janeway over Kirk, although I do love Kirk. I think the thing I do like the most is just how the whole crew of TOS together. I think that's what I enjoy most about that. It's not necessarily that I specifically love Kirk, but I love the way that whole crew works together. So that, I think, is influencing my decision towards that. I guess if I had to choose one, it would be Kirk, and for that reason. I think you made a solid argument for Janeway's leading your decision, but I think I'm more strongly influenced by the entire crew's impact. And I think that the relationships, I mean, obviously there's few things more iconic than the relationship between Spock and Kirk. And I think that so far as setting the mood for this ship is like, that's, I think that's the prime example.
Yeah. Spock, Kirk, and McCoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think that is pretty good. I do want to give a quick shout to Captain Archer. I think that is had one of the least believable casts, but it had one of my favorite characters, which is Trip Tucker, the engineer. He's like this good old boy from Florida, and he fixes stuff. He's the kind of the space, the Star Trek version, the Star Trek equivalent of duct tape and bubblegum sometimes, which I always liked. I mean, he's very much, you know, he's in a much earlier age. The Federation doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
At that point. But Archer, the problem with that entire show was that it just didn't quite, it didn't quite have it.
See,
I don't know. There's so many little problems.
Do you know, I completely forgot that Enterprise even existed. Like, until you said that, I was like, oh my gosh, I completely blanked on the fact that Enterprise was even a thing. And it has Scott Bakula in it. I mean,
I know Scott Bakula is great.
Yeah. Scott Bakula is great. But I just completely, when you said that, I was like, oh crap. Yeah. That was the thing. Yeah. Completely blanked. Oh,
well, thank you so much for indulging in my simmering passion that is Star Trek.
I mean, it's, I think for good reason, at least for the older stuff anyways. Why you still have a passion for it is frankly,
because I think you're
a masochist, but
yeah, a bit. It's in the words of the Beach Boys, it's so sad to watch a sweet thing die. Yeah, that's the Beach Boys, people. Yeah, those dudes were on drugs.
Well, so was most people back in the day.
Anyhow, I did want to leave you and the audience with this sort of. So there's a quote from Kirk. You can look it up. The speech about risk. You know, what do we do here? You know, why are we out here? Why are we doing this? Which is a question. It's an excellent question for Star Trek. You know, if you have a perfect society, why would you want to leave it? Well, he says it's that we are out here for the risk. We are out here for the chance to explore, to see new things, to go to new places, to boldly go. In fact, they split the infinitive just to piss off all the pedants. Like me. and that very much, that risk speech reminds me of why I like Star Trek, why I like that idea that humanity can transcend this current age, that we maybe things do get better, maybe things can improve, and that there isn't just a dystopian, you know, sad face emoji future waiting for all of us. So
I think that that's a great hopeful thing to end on. And next month we'll talk about all the dystopias that we have to look forward to.
It's gonna be great.
Thank you for joining us this month, guys. We will be back next month with a new episode. Until then, my name's Eli Carlson.
I'm Jake Haddad.
And this is In Which. Have a great rest of your life.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, so this has got to be something. Like, this is like Once Again with Feeling from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Sure. Or
like
the something Scrubs is. Episode.
Yeah, something is affecting them. It's really stupid that they did this. This is stupid.